Hello, I'm Rosie Goldsmith and a warm welcome to the Slightly Fox Summer Podcast, brought to you by the Slightly Fox team here in Hoxton Square, London. We've got a bumper summer reading edition for you today, with a focus on the great Scottish novelist, short story writer and poet Muriel Spark. But first, I'd like to hear what's been going on at the Slightly Foxed office since we last met 3 months ago and what we have to look forward to. So I'm very happy to see publishers and editors Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood back round the table with me again. And you're going to bring us up to date with Foxed News. Gail, what's been going on?
Well, we've had a lovely June. It's so nice to have the sun back. And we started off the month with a launch at a bookshop in Cambridge, which is rather a special bookshop. It's called Bodies in the Bookshop, and it exclusively sells crime fiction. And it's been going for not long. It's down St. Botolph's Passage, and anybody who likes crime and is in the area, I do recommend it. And we had a launch in the church opposite the bookshop for Nigel Slater's memoir Toast, which we've just reissued.
So it's not about crime fiction as such, because I don't associate Slightly
Fox. But they hosted it. They hosted it. And Nigel came along and signed lots of copies, and we met lots of subscribers from the area. It was a beautiful evening, and we sat outside in the churchyard afterwards and had a drink. And it was just a very nice occasion.
And we are having the most wonderful summer. We're so blessed, aren't we? Hazel, what have you been up to the last few months?
Yes, well, you know, we like to sort of try and get out and about a bit and see the subscribers and get some new ones. And we took part in a little festival down in, actually it's in Gales Village down in Devon. It's called the Two Moors Festival, and we were a sort of taster for that. And we spoke in the church, which was beautifully decorated because there was a wedding next day with all sorts of lovely natural flowers. And a lot of people came, I think about 60 people, wasn't it? And then afterwards we walked across this dreamy village green to the village hall where everybody had cream teas.
Were you wearing a floaty dress, Hazel?
Well, that's not quite my style, as you know, but I did my best.
I'm sure there were lots of floaty dresses. We've got the Slightly Foxed magazine coming out this summer too. What have we got in that?
We have. Well, the autumn issue has just gone off to the printer and it's full of good things. It's there's a piece on George Orwell's coming up for air. A very entertaining piece on Sydney Smith with a wonderful recipe for, in verse for the perfect vinaigrette. Michael Blakemore, who is an Australian theatre director, has his memoirs and novels about the stage. A Romain Gary novel called The Kites, and he was the most extraordinary French novelist who invented and reinvented himself and won the Prix Goncourt twice, once under his own name and once under a pseudonym. A bit of a rogue, I think. So yes, there's lots of nice things in the issue. And we're reissuing a memoir by the youngest Battle of Britain pilot called Geoffrey Wellham, called First Light, which is an incredibly immediate, gripping account of how he enlisted when he was 17 and survived the Battle of Britain, and I really do recommend that. And we're reissuing Cider with Rosie as a plain fox edition because we've sold out of the original and people still love it. So
guess what, I do too. Yeah, I have to. It has
do.
My name
of
on
course
it
you do. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Gail and Hazel. I'm really curious to hear what you both think of Muriel Spark. I have no idea, so I'm looking forward to that. Now, I promised you Muriel Spark, the great Muriel Spark, born Edinburgh 1918, died in Florence 2006, no longer with us, but we have the next best thing. Her biographer, Martin Stannard, and Sparkian enthusiast Emily Rhodes, our special guests today. Now, I do wonder whether Sparkian is a word, but definitely sparky and sparkling to describe Muriel's writing and life, and indeed to describe Emily Rhodes, my dear colleague. Welcome to our Slightly Fox podcast, Emily. Now, you are a podcaster as well. You're a book lover as well. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do.
Oh, it's so lovely to be here. And I'm so thrilled to be described as sparky.
And sparkling. Sparkian.
I mean, and sparkian. All sorts of sparks. Actually, the way I use spark the most at the moment is in the charity that I founded a year ago, BookBanks, which brings books into food banks. What we do is we partner with a food bank, we put up a little free bookstall, and the looked after by two volunteers from the book world. And they not only give the books out and help people accessing the food banks to find the right books for them and their families and friends, but also use the books to spark conversation, which, as everyone, all readers know, that any conversation that begins with a book never ends there. You know, you go off in all sorts of directions. Books are a great icebreaker and a brilliant way to bring people together and get conversations going.
Well, we will all support that. In fact, we'll put all the details on our website as well to accompany this podcast. So thank you so much, Emily.
That would be fantastic.
I know you do much more.
Yes, sorry, I've talked a lot about that. Can I briefly say Emily's Walking Book Club is the other main thing?
And Emily's Walking Book Club is very relevant to our Muriel Spark podcast.
It is, yes. So Emily's Walking Book Club began when I was a bookseller at Daunt Books in a bookshop right next to Hampstead Heath. And our very first book was A Far Cry from Kensington by Muriel Spark. And I will come on to talk more about it. But basically, we meet once a month to walk and talk about books on Hampstead Heath, now also in Regent's Park. There's also a weekly newsletter, and we have nearly 4,000 members. Though thankfully, they don't all show up to walk at once.
Do you sort of walk and then stop and have a little
yeah.
chat?
Yeah, I'm very strict that people have to have come having read the book. What we do is we begin in a big group, and often there are about 50 of us or so. And I'm quite bossy on these
calls. You have to be.
I mean, I have to be. But I give people a task or a question or, you know, something to discuss. And then everybody very naturally and organically splits into groups of two, three or four people as we trundle off along the path. And we have probably four or five stops over that walk. And each stop we gather together. That's a chance to exchange ideas, share what we've talked about. Maybe I'll read a bit out. And then I set people off on a new topic. And I very bossily insist that they have to talk to someone new each time. So it's a really good thing to do if you're on your own, if you're new to London, and some really brilliant friendships have been formed, I think.
It's a wonderful,
such
wonderful
a good
idea.
Yeah,
thanks.
So we'll hear more about Muriel Spark and walking with Muriel Spark later. Thanks, Emily, so much. You're doing amazing things. Now, Emily and Gail, Hazel and I have all been rereading and reading Muriel Spark's novels and stories in preparation for today's podcast, as well as immersing ourselves in Martin Stannard's biography of Muriel Spark. Now, with all of us around the table being Spark enthusiasts, it really helps to have somebody who knows what they're talking about, a Spark specialist
yes.
with us. The authorised biographer, the writer and academic Martin Stannard, also Emeritus Professor of Modern English Literature at Leicester University. Welcome, Martin.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Martin, your two-volume biography of Evelyn Waugh
yeah.
made your name as yeah. a biographer.
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Which year was that published?
Well, the first was 1986, I think, and the second volume, 1992, and that's where Muriel comes into the story.
Well, I'd like to talk about Muriel's biography later on with you and how you actually came to write it, but how did your, let's put it, long and eventful association with Muriel Spark begin?
Well, that began because she reviewed the second volume for the Daily Mail.
Of the Evelyn Waugh
of
biography?
Of the Evelyn Waugh. And reviewed it very well. It was only a short review, but it was a very good review, and obviously with her name attached, it was quite important. And she chose it as one of her books of the year. So I, as I always did, and still do, if I've got a nice review, I write to the reviewer and say, thank you very much. And then out of the blue, I got a card which arrived in my pigeonhole in an envelope, which said, kind of, not at all, I hope I have as good a biographer as you when my turn comes around.
Was that hint, hint?
Well, who knows? and it was signed Muriel Spur. And I thought, who the hell is this? I thought at first it must be one of my friends on holiday in Italy, having a joke, because they probably knew that it had been reviewed by her. And I thought, well, could it really be Muriel Spark? So I wrote back and said, if this is really you,
She said no.
And if you are seriously interested, look no further, because I've always admired your work. And it would be a great honour and privilege to write your biography.
Let's talk about her own biography, her story, if you like. But let's give us a potted history of Muriel Spark before you came to write the biography. And we'll talk about that later. But also, it'll give us some context, I think, for talking about her novels, which is what we all want to do.
Sure.
So Muriel was a poet, a literary critic, as you mentioned already. She wrote short stories, she wrote novels, she wrote essays, she wrote an awful lot. She was very, very prolific. But where did it all begin?
Well, that was one of the things I discovered, which I think she didn't particularly wish me to publicise, which was the fact that she came from a working-class family. I don't think anybody knew that before I put it into the book. So she talked about herself coming from an ordinary-class family.
She was born in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Very important to say, I believe. Yeah. And she was born in 1918.
Yeah.
She was the elder of two children.
Yeah.
Philip, her brother, came next. And as you say, they grew up in poverty. Her parents weren't able to send her to college, so she wasn't able to do any further. She was obviously very
bright.
They
did spend money on sending her to a fee-paying school, also Philip, because, you know, as often in Scottish households, education was thought to be the escape route from poverty. And she went to a very nice school. Actually, what we would think of these days as being a local grammar school, really. It was that kind of school, full of very good teachers, enthusiastically cultivating their charges. One in particular, of course, who in a transformed fashion became Miss Brodie.
Indeed.
Miss Kay.
And that's also where Muriel wrote her first poetry. And was she 12 when she had her first poem published?
Not sure when she had her first thing published, but she...
Anybody else know?
I think she was very young, around that age in the school magazine. And they normally only published one, but they decided, the English teacher decided that she published four or five because Muriel Spark appeared to be preternaturally talented.
She was Muriel Camberg that time. She became Muriel Spark, didn't she? Now, she didn't go to university, which she might have wanted to do, and was obviously bright enough to do so. She got married at the age of 19 and went to live in Rhodesia, today Zimbabwe, which was a huge leap from Edinburgh to Harare. Mm. How did that happen? Who was the lucky, unlucky man?
He was a chap called Sidney Oswald Spark, who, of course, became known as SOS. And he was probably a highly intelligent man, Jewish, and I think he taught mathematics. So he also came from a very ordinary background. So he was working in Edinburgh and met Muriel. Muriel, I think, saw it as a chance for escape, something exotic about it. I think she probably in those days, although she laughed about it later, thought of him as an intellectual. And he unfortunately didn't tell Muriel that he was undergoing psychiatric treatment. So something went terribly wrong with him and he was seriously mentally ill. So he goes out first and she arrives in Africa and finds him very strange indeed, to the point where I think he attacked her once. And he, as many men in Rhodesia at the time did have, had a gun and would fire it off in corridors. And she thought, I've had enough of this game of soldiers, and walked out with her son and went to live with a friend. And from that point was on her own and found various jobs. She was a good, fast typist. She had shorthand. And later on, she was described by Peter Owen, the famous independent publisher, as the best bloody secretary I ever had. She would have made a fabulous literary agent or publisher She had a good, strong, brilliant business sense. She had a habit during her life as a writer of jumping ship from publishers just before they went under or went slightly wobbly, and managed to go to another publisher who would pay her more. So she was very, very good at managing all the business side of things.
So we've moved from Edinburgh to Harare, back to Edinburgh, then to London. She moved to London.
Well, she came back during the war because she said she wanted...
The Second World War.
Second World
course,
War,
yes.
Because she wanted to be part of it.
Now, this meant that her son and her husband were no longer with her. And, I mean, there's so many things, really interesting facts you've mentioned and thrown out there. You've mentioned the fact that her husband, who she then divorced, was Jewish. Religion played a major role in Muriel's life. And she was half Jewish, because her father was Jewish, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
But her son then, Robin, he converted to Judaism.
Well, he wouldn't say he converted. Mm. He would say he was Jewish through the female line and that Muriel was lying.
But Muriel's mother wasn't Jewish.
Well, according to him, she was. And there was
According to you?
According to me, I don't know.
Emily.
Wasn't Sparks' mother's mother Jewish? Is that right?
We don't know that.
We don't know that.
No.
So this became a very big issue, of course, and mother and son parted company. And you've come to the conclusion, which supports Muriel's theory of her own life, is that she wasn't Jewish through her mother.
Well, I've come to the conclusion that we can't know. So both sides in this dispute were saying there is evidence which clearly states my case. I'm not sure that's true.
Now, why is any of this important to the story of Muriel Spark? That's what we want to know.
In a way, it's not important to the story of Muriel Spark in the sense that she went on her way rejoicing and just put it all behind her, but her son wouldn't let it go. So it was important to his sense of identity as a Jewish man. It was important to his social reputation. It was important because he became a Jewish painter. A painter of Jewish worthies and the like, and using Jewish symbolism. And he would not let it go. And as far as he was concerned, his mother was self-deceiving in this respect.
Now, this idea of whether it's invention or self-invention for Muriel, is that important? I mean, she converted to Catholicism, which did become very important in all her novels. There's definitely a lot about that. But you know, what does it tell us about Muriel? About how she created her own story, if you like?
I think it tells us that she was always a visionary mind. And that this found form, first of all, in her poetry, and particularly in her connection with romantic poetry and the Brontes. And it tells us, rather like Evelyn Waugh, Evelyn Waugh once said that one of his characters in the Waugh trilogy once said, that the real is the supernatural. And that what we call the real, the daily world, is merely a passing shadow. And I'm sure Muriel would have agreed with that. So she felt, I think, that the supernatural was the real, and that she tuned in to the supernatural.
I think that's really helpful, actually, in our discussion now about the novels, because that's great background. Thank you very, very much, Martin. And so let's talk about her books, her writing. And
Martin, I was
Emily.
Going to say, listening to you talk about the story of her life so far, what struck me was how often she's escaping. You know, she's escaping her poverty, she's escaping her husband. Mm-hmm. She's really sort of trying to leave things behind her all the time.
Yeah, and she did it all her life. Yeah.
Yes. And, I mean, thank goodness she didn't become a brilliant literary agent or publisher.
Yes.
Because I feel she really found herself. She escaped into these books that she wrote.
Yeah, absolutely. The original title for my biography was Vanishings, From Ode, Intimations of Immortality. And the way that Wordsworth talks about the self there is very much, I think, how Muriel would talk about the self. Then I came up with another idea, which was The Nine Lives of Muriel Spark.
Which would have been a very good title as well.
Yeah. And they were all, as you say, they were all quite different lives. And she would just walk out of one, close the door on it, and not want to know about the people in that previous life. And a lot of people, of course, who felt close to Muriel in those previous lives felt more than a little hacked off that she didn't want to know them anymore. I think they saw it as snootiness. She saw it as a bid for freedom, not being trammelled up in all this stuff that had gone with this previous identity. So she kept reinventing herself, which is great.
Well, she reinvented herself, or invented herself, as a novelist as well. So she'd done the poetry, she'd done a lot of literary criticism and so on. But she didn't publish her first novel until she was 39. That was The Comforters. But she made up for it, didn't she, by writing a novel a year after that. So she wrote 22 novels in total. And I actually took this quote from your book. She said that writing novels was the easiest thing I have ever done. If only. I would love to be able to say that. Now, everybody's been listening very intently to your story of Muriel's background. So now I'd like to bring everybody together to talk about the books. Emily, I would like to start with you because you have been our most loyal reader, I think, of all of them. You've got your pile of books next to you as well. So which have you read? Which did you like? Why? And yeah, let's go for it.
So which have I read? So the very first Muriel Spark book I read when I was at school, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, when somebody gave it to me and said, this is a book about teenage girls. Enjoy. And you know, it's about completely not about that. It's about so much more. But it sort of haunted me. I read it and I did enjoy the bits about teenage girls and the bits about sex and all of that. And somehow it was Mussolini brought into it. But I really felt like I didn't really understand it fully. And then I had a sort of long gap from Muriel Spark until this fateful day in the bookshop when I had decided to start the Walking Book Club. I knew we were going to somehow take books onto Hampstead Heath and talk about them, and I needed to find the first book. And I was sure only of one thing, that that book couldn't be a new book. It also couldn't be a book that everyone knew about. It had to be somehow secret, a kind of hidden gem, a book that would be just familiar enough for people to want to read it, but that they wouldn't already have read it. And as I stood there staring at the shelves, you know, I eventually got to S and Muriel Spark and saw next to The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. I was like, oh, I remember reading that. A Far Cry from Kensington. And I can just say it immediately just had to be that book. And I think one thing about Muriel Spark books that is so enticing are their titles. You know, A Far Cry from Kensington, or Loitering with Intent, that we've just discussed in the Walking Book Club as well, or Girls of Slender Means. They're often these quite colloquial phrases that seem somehow familiar. They kind of draw you in. You want to pick it up and think, you know, at the time I thought, ha ha ha, in Hampstead, we are a far cry from Kensington. Of course, this Walking Book Club on Hampstead Heath must begin with this book. But she almost does this, well, she does this incredibly clever thing, which she somehow explodes that phrase and gives it a double meaning, or possibly even more than double meanings. But in A Far Cry from Kensington, you know, while you're there thinking about this easy phrase of being a far cry from somewhere, there is also this incredibly painful, piercing far cry of horror that comes from Kensington. The Girls of Slender Means, you know, at one side you think, oh, they don't have much money, but they also have to be incredibly thin and sort of grease themselves up to be slender enough to escape out of the window when a bomb goes off. You know, there are these other meanings.
Frank Kermode described that book as a little miracle of a book. And it was something which she just squeezed in. because she was writing her what she thought was going to be her masterpiece, The Mandelbaum Gate, and just got fed up with it. It was getting too long, and she was running out of money, and used up the advance, and so did what she called a quickie, which was this. In my view, probably her best book. It is indeed a little miracle of a book. It has so much packed into it, even in the historical context where it's set between VE Day and VJ Day, when everything is hanging in the balance.
So that's The Girls of Slender Means. Mm. And then, as you said, A Far Cry from Kensington, which was the one that shouted out at you. That was about publishing, basically, wasn't it?
Yes.
And that was sort of 1950s, so a little bit later than mm-hmm. Girls of Slender Means.
Yep. There's also, of course, Prime Miss Jean Brodie, Loitering with Intent. I also had quite a sort of, I suppose, maybe a Sparkian experience of discussing Memento Mori with a book club I used to run for older people, which...
What a book to choose.
Well, Gail. It was this
I want to know why, Gail.
Yeah. Why? It's all about death, isn't it?
It's about
old age.
Yes.
And
yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It's incredibly funny.
Yeah.
But it's very black.
It was quite on the nose. My brief for that particular book club was to choose books about older people. So I was like, oh, I've got a great one here.
Quite an original one.
Yes. Yeah.
How did it go down, Emily?
Well... I think people did see the funny sides, but there was definitely a feeling of unease. And to be completely frank, as Sir Quentin from Loitering with Intent would say, I think people were a little put out by this constant... You know, the plot is everybody receives... there's these anonymous phone calls saying, you're going to die, or whatever it is. And I think it was a little bit much...
It is very much on the nose. It's a very, very
and the
tough
scenes
read.
In the Gail. The geriatric ward are just Granny Trotsky lives in the memory. All these and they're all called Granny, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm.
And they're all more than themselves as they approach. Well, they're all very old and they're approaching death.
But she always liked older women.
Great,
you know,
comedy.
Funny, crotchety, eccentric older women. Right from the time she was involved with her grandmother who was living in their flat in Edinburgh and who had a stroke and then aphasia and was calling things by all the wrong names, and Muriel relished it.
To my mind, one of her best characters is Lady Edwina in Loitering with Intent. You sort of wheeze on demand on the floor. Which, I think it's incredibly bold that, you know, incontinence is a very difficult thing to handle as you're getting older, and here Muriel Spark transforms it into this kind of superpower.
Yes. I must say, I did wonder
Hazel,
when
have you read Loitering with Intent?
I haven't read Loitering with Intent, I'm afraid.
You must, though. You'll love it.
Yes, I've read Memento Mori, and I did, when I opened it, think, oh dear, am I actually going to be able to read this? Mm. But it is so funny and so sharp, and it just made me laugh, really, a lot.
Mm. I think that is something about certainly all of her books that I've read, is that they really make you laugh. And I think they're incredibly readable. You know, once you sort of lured you in with this sort of easy title, you're reading away, sort of laughing away. And then often, I mean, it's interesting you were talking about having this launch in this crime bookshop, because often her books have this feeling of a whodunit or a kind of crime caper. And, you know, in The Comforters, her first book, there's this another granny who is smuggling diamonds and loaves of bread, and is completely eccentric and brilliant. And in Loitering with Intent, there's this whole thing about stealing manuscripts and getting a key to someone's flat to sort of break in and lift the stolen manuscript out of the knitting bag and replace it with a ream of typewriter paper. It's kind of very readable and almost of this different genre, but at the same time she's asking these massive questions about truth and loyalty and a morality, and she's got these two things going on at once all the time, I think.
So Muriel Spark managed to be both popular, accessible, and what you call a writer's writer.
Yeah.
So she was everything to everyone, really.
Yeah,
hence her great success in so many different areas. And And also, she was obviously trying out so many different styles, so many different approaches. And there's the humour you spoke about, Emily, which, in fact, it's not funny ha-ha. It's just so clever.
Mm. It's and so clever and it's so eccentric. I think it's such a...
It's wordplay as well.
There's a lot of wordplay, but I think she sort of sees reality and finds the weirdness and the magic in the real, in day-to-day life. She takes... You know, these things happen in her books that you can't quite believe, but yet you do believe. I mean, I can just imagine a granny smuggling diamonds and loaves of bread. I mean, it seems kind of far-fetched, but it's not beyond the realms of the possible.
No.
And she's fearless. I think that's the other thing, too. And that helps her to become so audacious with the language as well. I mean, I want to talk briefly about The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. We've been skirting round her, so to speak. She's so central, that book. Mm. For me, it is the best. I haven't read all of them, I admit. But, you know, I really do love that book, and I've loved it again. I think, as you were saying, Emily, as well, we read differently at different stages in our lives. And I have just reread The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. It is brilliant. It is an absolutely extraordinary book. And of course, it's set in Edinburgh. It's her only Scottish set book, which makes me think that Edinburgh must have had a great influence on her. It's about schools. It's about this woman, Miss Jean Brodie, played by Maggie Smith in the film. And it is about these girls, the Brodie set, these girls she nurtures to become her acolytes, basically. And there's a lot of politics in it as well. There's fascism, Spanish Civil War, Nazis. It is such a clever book. Yeah. There's so much about Scottish language, Scottish dialect, Scottish life. And nevertheless, we never see inside Miss Jean Brodie's mind. Mm. And I wanted to ask you all what you feel about that. There's no real kind of outpouring of the soul in Muriel Spark's book. She's not an internalised writer. She's not somebody who's constantly talking about her emotions. Anybody else?
No, she's certainly not a confessor. But she does write about fairly directly about her own life, particularly in those two novels we've been talking
Does her life feature in all her novels?
In one way or another, yes. It's interesting that you use that word nevertheless, because that is a very important word to Muriel.
Can we pronounce it in the way that she heard it?
Are you Scottish?
No, I'm not. Can anyone do it?
Nevertheless.
That's it.
Nevertheless. That's right. Yeah.
Emily, I know you love this word, nevertheless. How did Muriel use it? And it was in your notes, in fact, for your book group, Loitering with Intent.
Nevertheless feels like such a crucial part of Muriel Spark's work. She talks about how she heard this word growing up in Scotland all the time. And it's this idea of a paradox, of things being contradictory, you know. So she talks about it with her, I think you find it in a lot of her characters, that they are sort of one thing, but also another. And in Loitering with Intent, there's a passage where Fleur, who is sort of telling the story of the book, our narrator, she talks about how all the characters are truly themselves when they have contradictions, and that whenever they don't ring true, it's because they're trying to be too much of the same thing. So it's this sort of incredibly convoluted situation where she is sort of helping people write their memoirs. So whenever she thinks that they're not believable characters, she just adds in something totally contradictory to make them more real. And she says this is something she could apply to people in her life as well. And actually on the Walking Book group, I got us all to discuss this and to say, you know, did we agree? And we all agreed that actually human character is very much made up of these conflicting impulses. And when you look at where someone's got to, you know, there's never really a straight path to getting there. There are all sorts of things kind of coming in and fighting against each other. And the more self-knowledge you have, the more self-aware you are, it's being aware of those contradictions and conflicts within yourself. And we all felt that very grateful to Muriel Spark for drawing our attention to this.
Bravo.
Well done, Muriel Spark.
Well done, Muriel Spark. Yes, I think we're constantly feeling it. Well done, Muriel. I mean, I'd love to hear actually a little bit more maybe from Hazel and Gail too, which books you've read. Let's start at the very beginning. Gail and Hazel, I called us all Muriel Spark enthusiasts at the beginning. Are you, in fact?
I have to be honest and say I read 6 of the novels. I loved The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which I had read when I was much younger, and I laughed out loud at Memento Mori. The others I did struggle with, and I remembered that probably 10 years ago we looked at Muriel Spark's memoir that she wrote called Curriculum Vitae, and I can remember ringing Hazel up and saying, I've just finished the first third of this, which is her childhood and growing up in Edinburgh, and it's absolutely fantastic. I think we're on to a winner. And I kept reading, and then we got to the Rhodesian section, which was fascinating. And then she comes back to London and starts editing the Poetry Review, and at that point I took an instant dislike to her because she spent a third of this memoir paying off old scores. And just when we're reissuing the books in the Slightly Fox edition series, you know, we need to feel some sort of empathy with the character. And by the end of Curriculum Vitae, I just thought, you're just not a very nice woman. And I didn't want to read any more. So we rejected it. So I have very mixed feelings about her. I can see that she was a genius, but a flawed genius. I think she must have been an impossible person to deal with.
Martin, was she a nice woman?
Well, I liked her. When we first met her, there were two completely different Muriels. So we were invited to drop in on our way to a holiday in southern Italy, which we did, and everything was delightful. We went out, we had a 3-year-old child with us, which we thought might not be quite the thing, but that was fine. And we were taken out to a trattoria, and Muriel and her companion Penelope Jardine were playing the boo game behind napkins, you know, to keep her amused.
With your daughter?
Yeah.
Yes, wow.
Well, that came as a very pleasant surprise. We had a lot of laughs, and it was like discovering a new element of the family. So it was great.
This is when you started your research for the biography.
Well,
this
was about when we were discussing whether I should do it.
You saw her several times then over the period of...
Oh, yeah, yeah, many times.
So you got to know her pretty well.
Yeah,
How did you feel about her at the end of that?
At the end, obviously, she was trying to kill my book, and I was trying to keep it alive. In fact, I had no choice because of the money that I'd accepted by way of advances, and I don't think she realised any of this. You know, had I just walked away from the book, which is really what she wanted me to do, I would have bankrupted my family. So it wasn't a choice. I just had to battle on.
And was it something that sparked it off?
Yes, Hazel, what made what was she objecting to?
Turn, as it were?
I had no idea what she was objecting to, really. We had a legal agreement which guaranteed that we should make every effort to arrive at an agreed text, but if we couldn't, she had no right to prevent publication. So that's what happened, except that the time that was allowed for negotiation in the contract was 6 weeks, and that became 6 years.
Good Lord.
Because she just, or somebody, just tore it apart. One of the interesting things, I'll say no more about it, is that all the commentary is in Penelope's hand.
Penelope Jardine, who was Muriel Spark's companion for the last 30 years of her life.
Mm. And I had no contract with Penelope, so I asked them to guarantee that Muriel had dictated every word, and they said she had.
What exactly was Muriel Spark / Penelope Jardine? What were they objecting to?
I think they were objecting to the fact that I revealed things that they didn't want revealed. It was nothing terrible. I mean, for instance, Muriel didn't like the idea that I was quoting bad reviews. Now, I think if you're going to try to convey the sense of a writer's strength in the face of attack, you need to know what it was these people were complaining about and what, how she was resisting it. My whole image of her was of a fierce, brave, essentially feminist, although she didn't like to be called feminist, woman who would stand up to anybody, no matter who it was. So all these kind of gentleman publishers and the like. And so she had a fierce row with Anna McLean, her publisher.
She had rows with lots of people, didn't she?
She had rows
Gail with and Hazel, knowing
pretty much everybody.
She,
yeah,
she was tough.
So you could kind of see it coming.
Did you, in the end, write the book you wanted to write?
Yes.
So this was published in 2009. She died in 2006. So did you hastily rewrite a few things, put in a few things you had wanted to put in all along?
With the help of a very, very expensive copyright lawyer, I put back in a lot of the stuff that had been cut out.
Was it the case that Robin wouldn't talk to you?
Yes.
Yeah. So Robin, the son, wouldn't talk to you?
No. Muriel gave me his phone number, and I rang him up and he put the phone down on me.
Is he still alive?
No. So he thought anybody coming from Muriel's camp would be on her side and out to demolish him. That wasn't the case at all. I wrote to him again later saying, are you sure you don't want to see me, because I'm very willing to listen to your side of the story and to report it. And I guess he just didn't believe that.
In the end, you spoke about possible titles before. You ended up calling it Muriel Spark, the biography. That was probably the safest title of all. But it is an absolutely impressive, readable, gripping, wonderful biography. I really congratulate you on that. But also, I think, why would anybody write biographies when they're so burdened with all these difficulties? So bravo.
Thank you very much.
Not only that, but Evelyn Waugh as well.
Of course, you don't think you will be burdened with quite those
difficulties. The hope springs eternal.
Because it took you 10 years or so, didn't it? Longer,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, well, it took me, I suppose I got started on it somewhere around about 92 and submitted it about 10 years later.
And there was not just managing Muriel, there was managing an awful lot of material. The little receipts, the archives, yeah. She had left and given you lots and lots of boxes.
Yeah, but she didn't give them to me. She sold them for a handsome sum to the National Library of Scotland. And when I first arrived, she took me down to a dining table on a lower floor. It was a huge table and it was piled about a metre deep with files. Wow. And she said it's the story of a writer's life and her struggle with publishers.
She really didn't like publishers, did she? I mean, loitering with intent is so unpleasant about publishers.
I think the figures she really seems to hate in her novels are these people who try to wield power and
interfere
and are doing something quite sinister, trying to have this sinister control over people. And it often feels to me as though there's this one force of sinister control, whether that's Sir Quentin and Loitering with Intent, or Hector Bartlett, the pisseur de copie in A Far Cry from Kensington, or even Jean Brodie in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, you know, these people trying to control the other characters. But then there's always this other character, whether that's Fleur or whether that's Mrs. Hawkins, hawk-eyed Mrs. Hawkins, or Sandy, who's, you know, got these sort of very keen-eyed and Miss Jean Brodie,
yes,
who are kind of against the sinister force, and they are trying to have their own force, their own telling of the story, and they are the ones who end up on top. Luckily.
Yes, it's about who's in control of the story.
Who's in control, yeah, exactly.
And there's an element of revenge in all her books, I think. She's taking revenge on those people she doesn't like.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think that's part of the pleasure. I mean, I know there's something not very nice about seeing somebody who holds a grudge and thinking, what a nasty person you must be. But I do, or maybe this is just me, but there's definitely a part of me that, really doesn't like certain people, and there's this sort of guilty pleasure in seeing it played out somehow.
You're far too nice to write a Muriel Spark novel.
No, but I think it taps into something in most people, surely. That
it's something that we would perhaps all like to say and do, and we don't. And Muriel Spark says it.
Yes.
And the reason I think that writers love her so much is because she writes with such ingenuity and turns of phrase, and you read out whole sentences. Hazel.
I suppose that's what I really deeply, you know, relished about her, was just her ability with dialogue. She did a sort of course in Précy, didn't she, at some point? And it's all so cut down to the bone. Mm. There's a wonderful scene in Miss Jean Brodie, isn't there, where the head is trying to get out of the girls what is actually happening, you know, and the way they avoid it. And it's so skillful and so clever.
It's very difficult, I think, with a writer who's written so much, and as we said, we could quote so much from her, but we're restraining ourselves. But I would like it very much if we could come up with a curated, slightly foxed Muriel Spark reading list. Good for the summer.
I would say, if you wanted an overview, her first six novels are nearly all works of genius. Possible exception of Robinson, which is a very strange, symbolic book, but nevertheless extremely interesting. So 6 years, say 57 for The Comforters through to 63 with The Girls of Slender Means, and I'd place The Girls of Slender Means very high in the ranking, if you like. I hate doing this, but I mean, you know, of
I'm sorry to put you in a difficult spot there.
But I mean, there are so many interesting things along the way, like, for instance, that The Driver's Seat, which is a very, very interesting, skillful, top-of-the-range postmodern novel about a woman who is seeking her own murderer.
Mm. So, Martin, on your list so far, we've got the big ones, as we call them, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, The Girls of Slender Means, A Far Cry from Kensington, Loitering with Intent, which I'm sure Emily would agree with, as well as The Driver's Seat, The Comforters.
I would have one of the later ones as well, Aiding and Abetting, one about Lord Lucan. You know, could have had it to the woman. I mean, she never stopped, and she nearly always produced something fascinating.
Could I add,
please
the
do
list.
Yes, everybody say, add their
this is a
favorites.
Slightly rogue suggestion, but from my reading of Muriel Spark, what I've really noticed is not only is she a fantastic writer, she was clearly such an avid reader, and so many other books are included in her books. There's Frankenstein, there's Cellini, you know, so many of her characters are writing books as well.
Cardinal Newman.
And I suppose I love the way that she maybe takes a line like that Cellini refrain of, then I went on my way rejoicing, and puts that into her own book. And I think that she is inviting us to do the same. And so much of life goes into her books, and so many books go into her books. But I think she's also saying books can kind of go back into your life. You know, please take quotes from my books, from other books, and sort of bring them into your own words as well, in your own life.
Oh, I mean, you're all telling me so many things as well. It just makes me want to keep reading Muriel Spark. And Gail, do you want to add any different books?
Well,
to
I would
the
add
list?
Memento Mori.
Memento Mori, which I
think is for anybody with a black sense of humour.
Hazel, what about you? Have you got one to add to the list?
Well, I did love The Girls of Slender Means, actually.
I just thought
that was, and I enjoyed Memento Mori in a sort of slightly masochistic way.
They're all tinged with some masochism, I think. But thank you very much to all of you for that. And you know, I think we have a fantastic list, and you'll be able to read all the names on our website as well. And before we leave you, Martin, and the subject of biography, there's a new biography of Muriel Spark. Mm-hmm. It's just come out by Frances Wilson. It's called Electric Spark, The Enigma of Muriel Spark. Now, you've read it. What do you make of it?
Very good indeed.
What a generous, kind thing to say as
a fellow
biographer.
I mean, it's very interesting because she doesn't give the whole of Muriel's life. So there's, for instance, nothing about her relationship with Penelope Jardine, which was 30 years of her life. And so it's mainly about the period of those first six novels. I think she's one of our great biographers at the moment. She wrote a wonderful biography of D.H. Lawrence. And she has this poetic style of writing, which projects great sort of necklaces of images and of key words, you know, which come up again and again. She structures the whole thing on the idea of there being four Marys, and that Muriel was one of these four Marys at different points in her life, and sometimes simultaneously, more than one.
Another book to add to the list.
Yeah.
Now, in fact, that does show how ahead of the game we are, because next year, 2026, will be the 20th anniversary of Muriel Spark's death. So hopefully our profile today also will add to that. And there's another biography, I think, next year as well, to mark the 20th anniversary. But it also goes to show that everybody around the table has contributed to this idea that there should definitely be a Muriel Spark revival, I think. So at this point, I'd like to say thank you so much to Martin Stannard and to Emily Rhodes for being our guests today, talking about Muriel Spark. And Gail and Hazel, don't go away. Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere who enjoy engaging with a wide range of excellent writing, past and present, fiction and non-fiction. Slightly Foxed champions the lost, lesser-known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The quarterly magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. That's well over 1,200 articles. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd prefer to talk to a human being in the office, then phone us in the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Foxed family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and our podcast. Do join us. So now for our summer reads, in addition to Muriel Spark, and I'm going on holiday very soon, and I have on my pile Caledonian Road by Andrew O'Hagan. Really looking forward to that. Death at the Sign of the Rook by Kate Atkinson.
You'll enjoy that.
Oh, I'll enjoy it. Thank you, Gail. I'm looking forward to that. Ministry of Time by Carr Bradley, who was a publisher at Penguin and then wrote her first novel. It's done incredibly well. And one of my personal favourites, The Director by Daniel Kehlmann, who is a German-Austrian novelist I know very well indeed. And it's just been translated into English. So that's me. How about you, Hazel and Gail? What are we going to hear from you? What are your recommended reads for this?
Well, I've been reading this book called Homework by Jeff Dyer. I hadn't read anything by Jeff Dyer before, but it's a memory of his childhood growing up in a sort of quite a working class suburban family in Cheltenham in the 1950s and 1960s. And I suppose just briefly to say, you know, what I liked about it so much was he caught the sort of feeling of sort of after war and the picture of his parents who'd never quite believed that rationing had ended, you know. So his dad was always doing things like filling the car with only half a tank of petrol, so they always ran out. And and the sort of rather heavy feeling of that period, which I remember, you know, the sort of empty front rooms with the drinks cabinet that was never opened and the piano that was never played, you know. And in a way he catches that feeling that in his own world, nothing seemed to be changing. I mean, the whole family, I can't go into them, but there was Auntie Dink and Uncle Eric. They all had sort of nicknames. And the visits were, nothing actually happened in the visits. You just sort of went round and looked at the allotment or whatever it was. But, you know, that sort of heavy feeling of nothing changing, and yet in the outside world, everything was changing. And I think it's a very clever book, and it's very amusing and also sort of touching. So that's what I would
recommend.
He's a
wonderful writer. I've actually heard him speak about homework, yes. And it's so engaging.
Yes, he's terribly funny about his dad, you know, who said things like, no, don't do history, it's all in the past. And never write anything down. as he became a writer, that was slightly ironic. But anyway, yes, I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much, Hazel. Gail, what about you?
Well, I read an antidote to Muriel Spark. So after six novels, I was feeling a bit frazzled. So I've just finished Of Thorn and Briar, a year with the West Country hedgelayer called Paul Lamb. And it is an account of a year. He lives in a converted Bedford horse lorry, and he, over the period of the year, he travels around Dorset, Somerset, Wiltshire, Devon, and from September through till March he lays hedges and restores hedgerows. When the hedging season comes to an end, he plants hedges, he does a lot of coppicing, he makes wooden panels out of hazel. He is completely immersed in the seasons and in his environment, and all his possessions are in this lorry, and he pitches camp on this farm or that farm, depending on where he's been contracted to work. He's so keen on reviving the skill of hedge laying, and he describes there are lots of different ways of doing it depending on which part of the country you're in. He's now actually running courses to teach people to restore these things which are vital for habitat and for the environment. As I say, there's no drama in the book. You just follow his daily routine. He goes and joins a charcoal burner at one point, and it's just very relaxing and very un-Muriel Spark. And I just loved it.
Sounds wonderful. And Gail, I love how you always bring us tales from the countryside, tales from Devon, tales from your life. And they're wonderful books, your recommendations, well, both of you, all of you. Thank you again so much. Thank you to Emily again, to Martin, to Gail and Hazel. And also thank you to my producer, Philippa Goodridge, and the whole team here at Slightly Fox, tapping away in the background here. Now, that's it for this episode. Have a great summer and see you again on October the 15th with yet more compelling storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, easily accessed on your podcast app or the Slightly Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com. And that's also where you can subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast, all of us at Slightly Foxed are united in our love of books and of great authors, past and present, in reading the very best contemporary literature and in rediscovering lost and forgotten literary gems. My name is Rosie Goldsmith. Thank you so much for joining me.